Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Snyder has spoken, written, and presented on the thesis that the central banks are led by highly credentialed, ham-fisted, incurious humans who present themselves as highly credentialed, apolitical, economic scientists. That's why it's very strange that over the last several weeks, Mr. Snyder has found himself in complete agreement at the conclusions arrived at by the Federal Reserve. And that's why I believe sincerely that we may be witnessing the very final episode today. This might be it. As Snyder retires in happiness, professional success, for having brought lightness to the darkness. We're going to talk about it in a minute. Boop. But first, friends, did you know that scientists know what poets do not? The Earth will end in fire. Yes, with the expansion of the sun, it's inevitable that the Earth will be burned to a fine vapor. How will you spend your next several billion years? May I suggest that you check out Jeff Snyder's recent writing at Real Clear Markets on the story of Xi Jinping's childhood. It was an absolutely fantastic essay, and we would normally go over it line by line and bring out the highlights, but the whole thing is a highlight. I thought it was fantastic, and I highly recommend it. And let me see. I guess I wasn't super prepared. Here's the title of it. The China of Today Seeks Nothing But Its Own Terms, July 2nd, 2021. Highly recommend it. Check it out. Well, let's go live now to the undisclosed location somewhere off the Atlantic seaboard. Jeff Snyder, head of global research. Welcome to the show.
Welcome, Emil. Thank you very much. Fantastic introduction, as always.
I'm trying to read commercials now, even if they're not real. Jeff, let's get down to business then. You don't feel comfortable agreeing with what the Federal Reserve has been saying, their conclusions recently. What are the two conclusions that they've recently announced that you agree with?
Well, I might feel comfortable agreeing with people like Jay Powell on very small things, like, you know, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west and things like that. But when we agree on topics of inflation or even the reverse repo program, it makes my skin kind of crawl. You know, my spidey senses start tingling because by and large, over the last many decades, I mean, five, six, seven decades, Federal Reserve, monetary topics, they don't usually get together in a very good way, especially recently, going back to, you know, 2007, 2008. The last thing you want to find yourself in to be in a comfortable, correct position is an agreement with any kind of central banker on the topic of money and economy. But here we are in 2021. The Federal Reserve's position on first inflation, this price deviation, price spikes, whatever you want to call it, what's going on recently, they believe that these are due to transitory factors. They won't last. Things will go back to normal. And as we talked about before, you know, a couple of weeks back, that was actually the position of Ben Bernanke in 2010 and 2011. Maybe people don't remember it that way, but that was the last time we had this level of inflation hysteria, money printing, all this other stuff that's coming home to roost. And what Bernanke said was, no, this is transitory. It'll go away. Now, we agreed with him then, as we agree with Powell today on inflation, but for vastly, vastly different reasons. So that's where we can at least be somewhat comfortable or somewhat okay in the fact that we're on the same side as the Fed, but not for the reasons the Fed thinks. And part of those reasoning goes to our second place where we agree, which is in this reverse repo stuff. Now, the reverse repo has become a topic of conversation because people don't know why. It's a big number, something big must be happening, therefore I'm going to look it up on the internet and see what some common definitions of it and try to piece together what's going on.
Also because it went from 0 to 60 like that, right? It wasn't gradual. It was a sudden
big number
shock.
That showed up almost out of nowhere. And of course, you know, whenever that happens, Federal Reserve money, all this other, what, you know, people start asking questions, what is going on here? And it's quite natural. It's quite positive. And what we have said from the very beginning is that no, it just, well, let's, first of all, the common definition, if you look up reverse repo in Investopedia, as I always say, is what you'll see is that this is a method for the Federal Reserve to soak up too much money or soak up reserves so that they can control short-term money rates. That's the textbook definition. That's the textbook use. In fact, the Federal Reserve actually used this reverse repo in 2008 during the crisis to accomplish that task, which tells you a lot about what went on in 2008, why they got it so wrong. But we're not going to go over that today because we've covered that many times before. So the idea in 2021 is super QE, TGA being drawn down as the government refunds bills and, you know, starts spending this quote-unquote stimulus. We've got a flood of money hitting the markets, reducing interest, short-term interest rates all across the board. And here's the reverse repo working as it's supposed to, soaking up reserves, keeping money rates from going haywire and some of them going negative, although it should be pointed out some of them did go negative in the repo market. But by and large, the idea is there's too much money, reverse repo soaking up, it's all working very well. And what we said from the very beginning is no. There's another side of this. There's always another side of this when it comes to money. And that other side is collateral. And what we've said is, yes, there is a flood of reserves coming onto the system. And so that is definitely creating some demand for reverse repo usage. However, big part of it is the fact that there is a shortage of collateral, especially treasury bills. Part of it that's being created by the federal government, the Treasury Department's refunding of bills due to the debt ceiling. They've shut down several cash management bill lines, which has subtracted collateral from the system, as well as risk aversion that takes place, which contracts the overall collateral pool and herds people into the best of the best collateral too. So you have those two things happening simultaneously, which creates the problem of collateral scarcity. Which the reverse repo, when you look at it from the perspective of cash lenders, is a solution to. It's not about too much money, it's about too little collateral. You can go to the Federal Reserve reverse repo window, and it's like you're going into the repo market, except you're lending cash to the Fed, and they're giving you back securities out of their SOMA portfolio. So if you can't find a collateralized lending arrangement in the private market, if say you're a cash-rich money market fund, you can't find anybody with T-bills to do a repo trade with you, go to the Fed. Or in some instances, dealers can access the reverse repo if they're short of collateral for other means, just trying to get through the day to make it to tomorrow. So the reverse repo, when we're looking at it, the other side of it of what's coming back is collateral. Not too much money, too little collateral. That's what we've said from the very beginning. And as Emil, I know you've pointed this out, I pointed it out too, it's not coincidence that we see anti-reflation and long-term bond yields start to materialize to the day that the reverse repo usage started to skyrocket. So people were piling into reverse repo, anti-reflation and long-term treasury yields. Those two things are the one isn't causing the other. Those are two reactions to the same thing, which is collateral scarcity.
Exactly. That's right. In previous episodes, we made the point, yes, I guess it could be. And you made the point, it is too much cash and there's a greater return. So
yeah, it doesn't have to be either or here. It could be both things simultaneously.
But the timing of when this happened, February 24th, 25th, 26th, May 18th, coincided with bad things happening in the monetary system. Well, so we've said that, and apparently YouTube is not blocked at the Federal Reserve computer network, right? They apparently can go online, and Mr. Jay Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, watches this show, and when he was questioned in front of Congress, what did he say? He said, Jeff Snyder is right. No. Well, no. It's between the lines, but he says, you could say there is a shortage of safe short assets. So yeah, that's why it's happening. There's a shortage of T-bills, not a lot of T-bills. Case closed. I'm going to shut down the internet now. This is the end of the episode, Jeff. But wait a minute. You say, we agree, but for very different reasons with vastly diverging views as to what it actually means. We know what you have stated. What does Jay Powell, who seems to be agreeing with you, what does he think this means?
Well, the response you just read was a response to a question from a Arkansas congressman who asked him specifically about too much money, reverse repo, maybe you should shut down QE, you're doing too much kind of a thing, especially since his previous question had been about the quote-unquote housing bubble that's taking place. So you could say Jay Powell is just saying that to, you know, sort of pass the buck to Janet Yellen, because implied in his response is, oh, well, you know, the Treasury Department is shrinking the level of bills that are being issued, and that's driving the reverse repo. Don't blame me and QE. It's not our fault. It's Janet Yellen's fault. But actually, in a funny way, he's actually not blaming Janet Yellen either. He's actually blaming the congressman who was asking him the question, because Janet Yellen has to shrink bills due to Congress not acting on the debt ceiling. So you could make this all about politics and say, well, Jay Powell was just saying the most convenient thing that passed the buck to Janet Yellen and then back to Congress again, and that this reverse repo stuff is all really benign and it's really just this technicality in the bill market. However, again, as you and I, you just talked about, there's mountains of evidence that, you know, Jay Powell is not being disingenuous here. He's actually looking at the system as it is and saying this is a deficiency and this is what happened, you know, the cause and effect. We have a deficiency, lack of bills, forcing a lot of people to go into the reverse repo, and that's a problem. Now, where Jay and I diverge is why that's a problem and what that actually means. To him, this is nothing more than sort of a monetary technicality, such as it was to Ben Bernanke's Fed in September and October of 2008, when they believed there was too much money back then too, despite the fact that the world had been melting down all over the place in every market. The Fed actually thought there was too much money, too much reserves that needed to be soaked up by this technical issue in the reverse repo. So in many ways, it's the kind of the same thing, if not to that level of trouble. Jay Powell is echoing Ben Bernanke and saying, we've got too few bills. We'll clean it up using a reverse repo. We'll raise IOER by 5 basis points. No big deal. All of this stuff is just a big, you know, stuff that we worry about that nobody else should. Of course, as we've said many times before, you don't let a collateral scarcity become anything worse than that, because as time and time again we've seen, that's where the big problems show up. If we have a collateral issue, scarcity can quickly become shortage, which then spirals out of control.
The word morphology means the study of the form and structure of things. Now, the very first time I ever came across that word was in 2016 while reading The Fourth Turning by Neil Howe and William Strauss. And they were talking about the morphology of this cycle, this four-generation-long cycle, the steps, the form, the structure of what you see for at least 500 years of Anglo-American history. You can see this echo. Well, what we're going to talk about is that, yeah, I guess it is just this technicality, except that it's part of a morphology. It's part of a structure. We see this, then this, then this, and as you just explained before I started talking, it leads to a severe acute dollar shortage, a crisis, one of the four that we've heard.
And absolutely, it's, you know, they want to look at this as a sort of a snapshot. This is today. This is what's happening today. The numbers are big, but you know, today is unrelated to tomorrow, which is unrelated to the day after that, which is unrelated to the day before, you know, yesterday. That's the, you know, and it's a deeply embedded ideological problem with economics, going back to Poincaré and every, you know, the idea that markets are detached and, you know, random walks and all these other things. But there's a tendency to look at these things as a snapshot. As you were just saying, Powell said, you know, yes, we have a we have a problem in Treasury bills. We don't have enough Treasury bills. But so what? That's today. It's we're handling it. We're working on it. When as you're about to do, I think, putting together that, no, this is another signpost in a, you know, walking down a specific path or going down a specific road that we have seen repeat time and time and time again. And knowing what we do about the importance of collateral, the repo market and derivatives, because collateral also applies to the derivatives markets and currency markets and all sorts of other things, that, you know, collateral scarcity is not a specific snapshot. It's an underlying condition that permeates pretty much the entire history, going back to Bear Stearns and before.
So I've pulled up a graph from 2009 through 2012, and we're going to go through a couple of these examples that show an event and then a landmine. What is the event and what is the landmine? What does that mean?
Usually there's been specific days, you know, snapshots where we see the treasury market seemingly go haywire, where yields will fall in a single day by double-digit basis points, which is so contrary to the dominant narrative or the mainstream narrative that, you know, hey, look, the world is recovering, things are going great, inflation is about to get high and out of control. So the last thing you would expect is a day where double-digit decreases in yields, not just in the U.S. Treasury market, but all across the world, because those two things are so hugely inconsistent, almost a buying panic in safe instruments that just doesn't make sense to the mainstream view of, you know, inflation recovery, QE, abundant reserves, too much money, all of these things, when you see essentially a scramble for liquidity. And so that day that happens, it was May 6th of 2010, which was overshadowed by the flash crash in the stock, U.S. stock market in particular, but that was a repo event, and you could see it coming. There were warning signs beforehand, and when the liquidity got sucked out of the repo system because of this collateral problem on that day, particular day, May 6th, it wasn't a snapshot of, you know, technicality. It was a warning that these things were, that the problem underlying was getting worse to the point that something snapped in the system that herded the entire global marketplace in terms of collateral into those best forms of collateral. And of course, it happened again a year later after QE2 on March 16th. Again, we had the, you know, March of 2011, if you recall, was a lot like it is today, where, you know, inflation hysteria was out of control. People thought money printing, QE2, it's definitely coming home to roost. You're going to see, you know, high levels of CPI growth. All these things were happening in early 2011, and then here we have this day on March 16th, where again, treasury yields, bond yields fell by double digits, which everybody said, oh, snapshot is a technicality. It's about the Japanese tsunami and earthquake and Fukushima and all these bad things. That's all it is. And yet, a couple months later, we get what we call the landmine, which is when it's almost like a gravity or a downdraft. The bond yields don't just fall in a single day, or they don't just fall at a regular pace. They fall quickly for months, and they drop quite a distance in a short period of time, which is sort of the final warning that this dollar shortage problem, collateral problem that's driving the dollar shortage, has reached such an extent it's probably past the point of no return. So that's really what the landmine signifies, is that this accumulation of warnings, which this, you know, collateral day is one of the most stark warnings up until that. By the time you get to the landmine, that's pretty much the signal that, nope, inflation's done. They never really had much of a chance to begin with, but now it's zero, and we're going back into a deflationary circumstance.
August 9th, 2007, May 6th, 2010, March 16th, 2011, October 15th, 2014. That's where we're going to turn to next. Jeff, quick one though. We've talked about November 20th, 2013, indirectly when we were talking about mortgage-backed securities and the taper tantrum. And then you have a whole essay at Real Clear Markets. To this day, the world still thinks it was about QE, July 9th, 2021. Folks, check that out. Would we include November 20th, 2013 in this list of single day events followed by disorder that would then lead to something worse, or no?
November 20th to me was about collateral, but on the mortgage side, so it's sort of more specific. And so I put that not as one of these collateral days, but as one of those warning signs, okay. An early warning sign that, you know, in the late 2013, again, inflation, the mainstream narrative, here was something that happened that was completely contrary to that, but I don't think it was I wouldn't put it in the same category as March 16, 2010, and certainly not as October 15, 2014, which is probably the granddaddy of them all, because if you remember October 15, 2014, and what happened on that day, and the early morning trading, which I think we're going to talk about early morning repo next week, but anyway, in early morning trading, you had just an utter collapse in interest rates. And again, October of 2014, everybody was super positive. The economy was overheating, best jobs market in decades. And here you see bond yields tank in a single day. I think the 10-year dropped 23 basis points high to low, which is an enormous single day move. And everybody, I'm completely confused. What the hell's going on here? I mean, this can't happen. The economy's overheating, not you know, sinking back into something like 2008, which is what that kind of a move indicated. And what it was, again, as we said, the collateral position becoming so untenable that it just snapped. Everybody was herded out of some other, you know, riskier forms of collateral and into, on a single day, the most pristine forms of collateral they could get their hands on, as fast as they could get their hands on, before it led to more dire consequences on an individual case, level. So October 15, 2014 was a big one that said, forget inflation, forget the jobs market, forget overheating. This is a severe warning in the monetary system that says deflationary pressures, particularly in the collateral side of things, are building up such to the point that they're becoming untenable. And it wasn't even 2 months later that we got the 2014 landmine, beginning in December of 2014, lasting all the way into February. It was a huge downdraft, and again, perplexing to the mainstream narrative. Why are bond yields falling? Why are inflation expectations falling when we believe everything's going correctly? It's because they missed these intricacies and details of how, first of all, what's going on in collateral, but how important that really is.
Perhaps we are assuming that people know this, but each of these dates that we mention, it doesn't remain within just the monetary order. This then spills over into capital markets, into society, and the real economy. So we've got a collateral shock, landmine, and soon enough, the economy, the real economy, is in trouble, which is what's most important. So
that's why most people don't know these dates is because, I mean, they should. Everybody should. These dates should be burned into everybody's memory. And the reason they aren't is, again, because people don't understand collateral. But, you know, the mainstream media doesn't understand this stuff either. Everybody, every story you see written about October 15, 2014 says the same thing. Oh, it was a computer trading problem in treasuries, because that's the explanation, the benign sounding explanation that authorities came up with, because it couldn't possibly be deflationary forces, right? Janet Yellen, QE, overheating, all this positivity in the economy. It couldn't possibly be what it was, because it's exactly the opposite case of what everybody was supposed to believe. And so time and time again, you know, March 16, 2011, oh, Japan, Fukushima, it can't possibly be deflationary, when 2 months later, we go into another crisis. I mean, all of these things happen in a very specific way. You could see them happening. You could tell they were happening as they happened. But if you're, you know, just a regular Joe on the street, you can understand why none of this stuff has ever entered their consciousness, because it's first of all misunderstood, but then it's completely rewritten as something that it's not.
People may be saying we're picking on Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen, but no, we're equal opportunity.
They deserve it. They earned that.
We're not going to leave Jay Powell out of it, because Jay Powell came into power February 2018 with the wind at his back of globally synchronized growth. Janet Yellen handed him a booming economy with inflation rising. I don't remember, but unemployment was low. Stocks were high.
Inflation was ready. It was all right there. We were on the cusp.
May 29th, 2018.
And again, what was May 29th? Same thing. Same exact that you had early morning trading. Safe bond, you know, sovereign debt markets, Germany, U.S., JGBs, especially in the U.S. and German markets, interest rates fall significantly, and the media fills up with stories about the Italian finance minister or something going on over in Italy. I mean, some ridiculous thing that had absolutely nothing to do with it. And really, as we talked about in the last episode, Emil, early 2018, you know, before Jay Powell ever steps into his office as chairman of the Federal Reserve, there was warning signs that things were going bad back then. So we have the same pattern repeat. We have these smallish warning signs build up, and then all of a sudden, bam, there's a collateral day that shows up that says something became untenable, something changed, it broke. In fact, you go back to May 29th, you see that across all these, you know, bond market charts, you know, inflation expectations. For that cycle, when did they peak? May 29th. And then a couple weeks later, Eurodollar futures inversion. And then within a few months, we have the next landmine, what made it absolutely clear inflation story was wrong the entire time. Deflation is back again. So it's really, as you said at the beginning, there's a pattern here. It's a defined pattern that repeats time and time again. Largely because these are the same problems that never get fixed. And the reason they never get fixed is because The world has been told a story about money and QE and bank reserves that just is not a legitimate story. It
Jeff,
isn't what happens.
Earlier, I asked you about November 20th, 2013, and you said that it was a warning, not exactly fitting the morphology here. Would September 17th, 2019, or February 25th, 2021 qualify as fitting our morphology? Do either of them qualify?
Well, the repo rumble in September of 2019, I think, fits, but as after Lynn, it is one of the, hey, we're seeing consequences of things going wrong. The deflationary pressures have arrived. They're obvious to anybody who's not captured by the mainstream economic ideology. And so the repo problems in September 2019 were just, here it is. Big problems are here. So it's not a warning sign that things are coming. It was a signpost that okay, post-landmine, here it is. Now, when we look at February 24th, 25th of 2021, which Fedwire, bad treasury auction, actually a blowout in interest rates. So it wasn't a collateral thing. It was a lack of dealer capacities to participate in the seven-year bond auction that was offered that day because they were shut down by Fedwire and started, in the back rooms trying to clear up all those transactions that clogged the system for a couple hours there. That was simply a warning. It was one of those things that, okay, abundant reserves, huge QEs, and yet we still have the same problems when dealers step back, markets get illiquid real, real fast. And that's really the money problem we're dealing with here, whether it's collateral or just, derivatives or something else. When the dealer system, which is what creates the money in this euro-dollar system, when dealers step back, as we did in September of 2019 and in a narrow case in February of 2021, bad things happen, and it doesn't matter what the Federal Reserve has done or is doing. It's just that was a reminder that the system remains in that fragile condition where if anything shocks the dealer system, forget it. It's a bad day for everybody. And that's not how markets need to – that's not something that markets are need in order to function properly in a dependable fashion. Markets need to be not worrying about liquidity. They need to be worried about, forward risks and things like that, investment opportunities versus, credit risk, not whether or not tomorrow morning the repo market's going to be completely illiquid because dealers woke up on the wrong side of the bed. That's the last thing you want to be focused on, and it's a deflationary reminder that the system is that fragile.
Jeff, in our next episode, we're going to talk about another signpost on the road to monetary socioeconomic Hades. And that's China lowering its RRP, which we'll talk about. What is
it? RRR. You're thinking about Jay Powell and the RRP, which I do all the time.
The shame, the shame.
There's too many initials, initialism.
Alphabets, acronyms. China's done something to them. They've done it before. What happens next? We're going to talk about it right after this. Ladies and gentlemen, if you were to put together a list, a morphology of steps that would lead to the next euro-dollar crisis, the next collateral shortage, you would find on that list something that China just did. So are we indeed heading towards another dollar disorder, another monetary shortage? We're going to talk about it in a moment. But first, friends, did you know that you can interact with the show? Yep. Simply go to YouTube and enter questions into the comments section. You can ask questions about the Eurodollar system or personal questions. For example, sometimes I'm asked by people, wow, Emil, it seems like you have it all. You've got a YouTube show, books, you've got a suit. How do you do it? And typically I respond, wow, that would be like walking up to Pavarotti and saying, teach me to sing to you. And I scoff at them. But, ladies and gentlemen, you can follow in my footsteps in at least one area, and that's by attending the Practical History of Financial Markets with Russell Napier, which is going to be hosted in London from October 7th to October 9th, a Practical History of Financial Markets course. Yes, do you want to know how to identify the bottom of a stock market bear market? Let's see, Russell Napier, he wrote a book about it. What about financial repression? What does it mean? How is government going to go after savers? These are all questions that can be brought up to Russell and his collection of market participants as they teach you things that are not in the textbooks. So just go to the Google, A Practical History of Financial Markets course, type in Russell Napier, and then you'll find the details of how you can attend this course. Jeff Snyder, head of global research, is on the edge of the shadows, and we're going to go to him live. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Emil.
All right. Jeff doesn't know what to say right now because I'm trying these new introductions and he doesn't know what to think of them. I don't know what to think of them, but this is your opportunity to go to the YouTube comments section and say, keep practicing. Jeff, you ask, how do you spell escalating? China, July 9th.
Yeah, C-H-I-N-A-R-R-R.
July 9th. I think that's how you spell escalating.
Yeah.
That's right. And you say there are three letters you never want to hit the Chinese news. I thought maybe USA, CCP, WTF. And then in the previous episode, I said RRP. Jeff, what are the three letters?
Yeah, what are the three letters? Yes, the three letters are the same letter repeated three times, which is RRR. Which, I mean, depending on how you arrange the letters, those stand for required reserve ratio, which is essentially Chinese bank regulators, the PBOC, telling banks how much in reserves they have to keep in reserves, therefore they're not allowed to use. How much bank reserves cash do they need to keep on their books in order to be in compliance and stay in the good graces of monetary authorities? So it's a rate.
If I opened up the New York Times to the business section, what would the New York Times, as the vanguard of the mainstream establishment media, say the China RRRR means when it's lower?
It means terrificness. It means stimulus. It means awesome. This is great. The PBOC is cutting rates and allowing banks to flood the Chinese economy with, I think you see estimates of a trillion RMB. Because that's how much reserves will be, quote unquote, unlocked by a lower reserve requirement ratio.
Okay, well, you've caught me. Where do we go next then, Jeff? I've got a section here highlighted. Maybe I'll read that out because it says read. At one time, all the way back in 2011, the triple R for large banks was an unbelievable 21.5%. Over the decade in between, according to accepted conventional theory, by reducing the triple R, this must have flooded China with trillions upon trillions of RMB banks were allowed to incrementally use to stimulate the Chinese economy. Only the Chinese economy has gone in the opposite direction during those 10 years. The money must instead of be missing, as is the economy. So much for the theory.
Yeah, so let's step back here. Let's review our history of China RRR. We'll bring in the Chinese yuan exchange rate. We'll look at internal money, external, and euro dollars, because that's what we're really talking about here. China's RRR, as we say, is a warning, but it's a particularly useful warning because it contains all of the elements in the global monetary system and global economy sort of compacted down into what looks like to be a Chinese technicality or a Chinese quirk. You know, this is something that the Chinese do, and how does that relate to the rest of the global economy? Why are we thinking that it's a warning? And when you look at, you know, what RRR is in the history of China over the last couple decades, the 21st century in particular, what you see is there's a very tight relationship between all of these things, starting with the euro-dollar system. As dollars are created in the offshore bank-centered system, quite a lot of them ended up in China, because why wouldn't they? China was a growing emerging market miracle where a lot of people wanted to go to. So a lot of dollars end up in China, and the way the Chinese manage their quote-unquote hot money system, or, you know, through via exchange controls, a good chunk of those dollars, as they come into China, end up in the hands of the People's Bank of China. In fact, the People's Bank of China, on its balance sheet, on its asset side, these foreign assets form the basis of the Chinese monetary system. In other words, RMB is essentially dollarized, and it has been for decades. And it, where this got into extreme proportions was in the 21st century, as the Eurodollar system really hit its final manic stride, and a lot of dollars flowed into the Chinese system. A lot of them end up in the hands of the PBOC, which requires the PBOC, because if the asset side grows, the liability side has to grow equally. Therefore, they have to create money as internal RMB money as the offset of all of these dollar inflows. So dollars go in, end up PBOC, PBOC creates RMB, mostly in the form of bank reserves, but a lot of currency too, in response to the dollar inflows, all hoping to maintain some semblance of balance in the currency exchange rate while attempting to not let the inflation and domestic inflationary problem become too severe. And the way that they do that is because they're forced to create all these bank reserves as dollars are flowing in. They tell the banking system, we're going to lock up your bank reserves. Yes, we're going to create these bank reserves as we take these dollars out of your hands and give you RMB in place of them, but you're not allowed to use them. So you have a lot more RMB bank reserves, but we're not letting you use all of them. You're going to have to lock up a portion. That's the RRR. So all of these things happen almost in a chain of causation. Dollars go in, PBOC takes them on, RMB bank reserves go up, and the RRR goes up in order for the PBOC to try to control inflation. So you have an external, internal direct relationship between dollars, RMB, People's Bank of China, and exchange rate of CNY versus the US dollar.
And right now I've pulled up a graph from your article that shows the relationship between the triple R and the US dollar and renminbi exchange rate. And from 2000 through 2008, what do we see? We see the exchange rate strengthening in favor of the renminbi, the US dollar is losing value relative to the Chinese currency, and the RRR is rising because for reasons that you just explained. But then we see steps down, Jeff, and they aren't random. They're not, oh, well, why don't we just do it here, there? No, they coincide with external dollar shortages. July 2008, July 2011, January 2014. It goes on and on until even recent day, January 2018. We see the triple R is lowered every time there's a problem, a global monetary shortage.
Yeah, because this process I just described up until, you know, really 2011 actually works in reverse. So if dollars are going in, that creates the PBOC's balance sheet increases, more money in China, more higher RRR to reduce the inflationary potential. In reverse, it works almost exactly the same way in all of the inverse ways. Dollars suddenly don't show up in China or actually recede. Guess what happens? There's fewer dollars for the PBOC to put on its balance sheet. Therefore, the bank reserves, currency, money side of the PBOC's balance sheet can't grow, or in some cases, especially after 2014, starts to shrink. And so the PBOC now has to deal with a dollar outflow situation, which is highly deflationary. And during these periods where there are fewer bank reserves because the central bank's balance sheet is actually shrinking, they have to then try to let the banking system make up for that monetary shortfall by reducing the RRR, so that in the exact opposite situation as before, they say to the banks, now you're going to have fewer bank reserves but lower RRR, which means you'll be able to use a higher proportion of fewer bank reserves. And the idea is that with the lower RRR, they can potentially manage not their inflationary potential, but the deflationary potential of this entire system going in the wrong direction or in reverse. So dollars out, PBOC balance sheet stops growing or shrinks, fewer bank reserves, and an even lower currency growth, and the attempted deflationary offset, which is a lower RRR. Now that sounds like it's a good thing. It sounds like stimulus, but as you just showed on the chart there, what we see is that whenever the PBOC is cutting the RRR because of this dollar problem at the beginning of the causation chain, it's a warning sign because it doesn't work. It doesn't actually lead to stimulus, because in a dollar shortage, global economy, deflationary, going the wrong way situation, Chinese banks are going to be risk averse, as well as a number of bad things going on too, which means, yes, the RRR goes down, and theoretically they could pump more RMB into the real economy, but in reality, they're not going to be willing to do any of those things. And that's what actually happens.
I had two paragraphs highlighted here that I wanted to read as being very important, and that's all I had. So let me know, Jeff, if you have any concluding thoughts. You just said one of them, which was that this is a causation chain that applies beyond China. Here you say, you instead of thus whenever RRR is reduced, rather than view it as stimulus, you need to see it as a warning. And we were just talking about this in our previous episode on morphology. The triple R might be one of the check marks. Another one is a collateral shock day, then a landmine when US Treasury yields or other sovereign bond yields accelerate lower. So this it's building, it's gathering. Here's my last contribution to this episode, Jeff. These Eurodollar squeezes or global dollar shortages are never one-off or short-run situations. They are long and involved processes that play out over a prolonged period of time. Each time, their earliest days or initial phase is marked and described by a series of escalating warnings, curve distortions, rising dollar, falling yields. In all four thus far, global dollar shortages, going back to 2008, triple R cuts in China have been just that, part of the chain of warnings indicating the monetary and economic situation going further and further the wrong way. Jeff, you mentioned a few other check marks on your list that you carry around with you at all times. Anything else on that list that we should be thinking, trouble?
Well, yeah. Before we get to that, I want to back up a little bit, and you know, there are our warning signs and where they played into history. You know, go back to 2018, for example. We talked about May 29th as sort of the big okay, things are really getting serious. But before May 29th, early in 2018, when supposedly inflation was, you know, global economy going the right way, everything going good, you know, globally synchronized growth, the Chinese cut the RRR. And this was during a time when the dollar had stopped falling and then began to start rise again. You know, so dollar strength, that's a bad sign. And again, the Chinese RRR links together all of these different facets because it is a response to dollar shortage, or, you know, central bank perceives that the dollar shortage is going to hit their balance sheet at some point, an attempt to reconcile deflationary pressures with what they can do internally in RMB. So it's a dollar problem that hits Chinese, and therefore is, you know, again, a comprehensive view of this entire situation. What we're really talking about here, and especially in the context of 2021, is mainstream narrative or mainstream expectations for inflation. Inflation is coming. It's all going to be huge. And while that narrative is, you know, solidly in place across the entire financial media, uniform, ubiquitous, it's monolithic, you know, inflation is definitely happening. The economy is overheating. Think back to early 2018, for example. And we see all of these little warning signs kind of, you know, they should be nibbling away at that narrative, but they never do. What they're really saying is that, no, the chances of an inflationary breakout are becoming smaller and smaller and smaller until we get to that big collateral point where it says, no, there's deflationary stuff going on here. And that's really what these warnings are. That's what the RRR is. It's a warning that, yes, everybody in the world is convinced of inflation because they don't understand how money works. And money, by the way, and inflation are absolutely linked together. And that's why time and time again, every time we get into these situations where we hear about these inflation, you know, the inflation narrative, think about 2014, same exact pattern. Everybody's convinced inflation's coming while we have underneath all the time, if you know where to look, all these warning signs, and eventually, yes, in February 2015, RRR cuts, which are saying deflation, deflation, deflation. And the deflation warnings, despite the mainstream noise about inflation, these deflationary warnings get louder and louder and louder and louder. And you can see them in falling bond yields. You can see them in Eurodollar futures curves, twisting, quirking, as we talked about last week, all of these other things. They're warning signs to tell you. They're telling you evidence. Forget the mainstream noise. It's all this stuff about inflation. Forget it. We're seeing this build up in escalation of deflationary pressures. And yes, we are seeing that happen this year in 2021. It is happening right now as we speak. We're seeing, yes, CPIs are through the roof. You know, the PPI yesterday, the commodity price index that was released, it was the highest since 1974. I mean, it sounds like the great inflation. But yet while that's happening, Deflation, deflate. The whispers of deflation are getting louder and louder and louder. And then last Friday, the PBOC cuts the RRR, which to a trained monetary ear, as we just said, this covers all the facets of Eurodollar global economy. That's kind of a big one. So what we're seeing is, yes, inflation, everybody's talking about, it's absolutely going to happen, but it's absolutely going to happen every couple years. And every time it's absolutely going to happen, it's because you're ignoring all of these deflationary warning signs that are happening. And again, as you pointed out, Emil, there's a pattern to it. And we're seeing that pattern reemerge in 2021, getting a little bit louder and louder and louder.
A minute ago or so, you said that money and inflation are inextricably linked. And I just had a little warning bell go off in my mind, because many people look to M2 as a measure of money. And I've heard on many different shows people say, well, they're not linked because look at M2. But as we've talked about in many shows already, M2 was disused or unusable or imprecise. It wasn't capturing what money had truly become in the 1960s. 1960s, ladies and gentlemen. So I don't think there is actually a measure of money that would capture the global monetary condition today. That's part of the problem. Perhaps that's the underlying problem of our entire show, Jeff.
Hey, as I say often, you know, how do you put collateral into one of the M's? You don't, right? It's completely impossible.
You have to, though. You've got to figure it out.
But you can't come up with a number that says, okay, here's money, and have it exclude the collateral side of things. So you just conceptually, when you conceive of the monetary system and monetary condition, you have to keep in mind collateral, which is why, as we talked about before, many times before, I mean, that's what we always talk about, is why we're trying to get at all these hidden shadow spaces by seeing how that stuff that's going on in collateral and shadow spaces is affecting everything. And the way that those shadow spaces are affecting everything in 2021 is increasingly warning about deflationary pressures that are building. And as Jay Powell and I completely agree about, we're buddies now, that is even reflected in something like the reverse repo usage, which is indicative of a T-bill problem or collateral problem.
If I had over 1,000 PhDs on my staff, I am very confident, Jeff, that I would come up with a method of factoring in collateral and money, and it would be the best method put forward in the last 50 years. I'm confident I would do that. But if you're incurious, maybe you just don't get around to it. Jeff, one country that doesn't have 1,500 or so PhDs on their staff of their central bank is El Salvador. And as we've recently heard, they have made the cryptocurrency Bitcoin, a legal tender, or at least it's working its way towards that. And you wrote an article, and we're going to talk about not only what that means at the superficial level, but kind of why, what led to El Salvador making this decision. And we're going to bring in something from the 15th century called ghost money as part of the answer. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about Bitcoin, an advanced 21st century form of money, and how it relates to the Stone Age money from the 14th and 15th century, gold, silver, and then some kind of a money that's doesn't belong to any time period, a ghost money that we've seen humans turn to time and time again whenever there's a dollar shortage. And there's no better person to talk to about these sort of things than Jeff Snyder. But before we do, ladies and gentlemen, did you know that, yes, you're watching this show most likely, but that you can also listen to it? Yes, we are available on podcasts. And many people think, well, I could be watching it, but you could be doing something more productive. You could be listening and doing something productive, something like exercising, perhaps getting your pump on at the gym, doing hot yoga, and if you are, send pictures, or running. Now, when you're running, you could be thinking about how to improve yourself, your society, your family. What difference can you make? How can you improve the world, your nation, your church, or religion of what kind? Or you could listen to this show. Now, I know what decision I've made, and I hope you make that same decision. You can just go to any of your favorite podcast hosts at Verbal, Apple, Deezer, iHeart, TuneIn, Castro, Google, Spotify, Pandora, Breaker, CastBox, Podbean, Stitcher, Player FM, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, SoundCloud, Listen Notes, Amazon Music, and Podcast Addict to listen to this show. Jeff Snyder, head of global research for Alhambra Partners, you were recently at the George Gammon Spectacular in Miami, which followed the Bitcoin Super Show, also in Miami. And it's like Latin America is leading the way for this cryptocurrency right now, right? They had that conference. Then we hear about El Salvador. But you know, Jeff, in your article, I learned something that is not in the mainstream press that led perhaps to El Salvador making this decision. Where shall we begin, Jeff?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, there's sort of a as you're alluding to here, there's a lot of confusion about what El Salvador did, even in the Bitcoin community, if you can call it a community. I mean, it's not a monolithic community by any stretch of the imagination. You've got Bitcoin maximalists, you have Bitcoiners who take Bitcoin is sort of a religion. You got all sort of, I mean, there's a wide variety of opinions in the Bitcoin community, which is a good thing. But you know, across those that wide variety of opinions, there's sort of a, you know, I don't want to say confusion, but there's a little bit of angst about, you know, it sounds like what El Salvador did is exactly what Bitcoiners have been preaching since the very beginning, right? Here we have a sovereign nation accepting a crypto form of currency, and what Bitcoiners would tell you is the primo, top level. I mean, it doesn't get any better than this crypto form of currency. And it's everything they've been talking about, almost everything. Now, most Bitcoiners will tell you is that the reason Bitcoin is going to win in the end is because the dollar is toast. You know, the Fed print money, go burr meme, the reckless money printing QEs, dollars going straight into the toilet. So the two things are, you know, that's the Bitcoin maximalist position, those two things. Dollar's done, Fed screwed it up, printed too much money, Bitcoin wins and takes the day. That's not what's going on in El Salvador. Actually, completely contrary to that, El Salvador is embracing Bitcoin not because they're ditching the dollar over fears of money printing, but because they're looking for a solution to the actual dollar problem, which is not Fed money printing. So that's sort of, oh yeah, this is good. El Salvador is embracing Bitcoin, but they're not doing it for the reasons we thought.
That's right. It wasn't as if El Salvador had been for years the leading proponent or some sort of instrumental force in the community, and therefore they make this announcement as a perfectly natural evolution of their involvement over many years. It was just sort of out of the blue, but not quite out of the blue.
But it wasn't, right? It wasn't out of the blue, right? Because just 3 months before they embraced Bitcoin, what were they doing? In early March, they were knocking on the door in Washington at the IMF saying, hey, we need a $1 billion bailout, which for El Salvador, that's an enormous bailout. I mean, that's a huge thing. For them to go to Washington and say, I need a billion dollars from the IMF, there's your first clue.
Okay. They asked for $1 billion, but really, what the problem was is that there's not enough dollars, not dollars, euro dollars, the real global reserve currency flowing through El Salvador. Isn't that right, Jeff? And so, Jeff, what is a reserve?
Dollars, right. They don't even have their own currency. Well, they do have their own currency called the colón, which wasn't dropped. They stopped printing it 20 years ago. I mean, the central bank doesn't print any more banknotes in coins. So, I mean, you could still theoretically transact in their local currency, but they adopted the dollar on January 1st of 2001, rearranged everything because at that time, everybody was doing it in some form or another, as we just talked about in the previous segment with China even. Everybody dollarized their economies. And El Salvador took it to the extreme where they said, we don't even need our own local currency. We'll just use U.S. dollars because they're plentiful. They're everywhere. We find them everywhere. We need them anyway because it's a global reserve currency and we're not going to be able to trade with anybody without dollars. So why not, you know, they're available here. They're available everywhere else around the world. So why not just local currency, domestic currency is a hassle. We'll just use all these dollars. They're plentiful. They're everywhere. So You can already see, if you believe that dollars will always be plentiful, you can't foresee any problem anytime, anywhere. But as we talk about, quite a bit on the show, ever since around, say 2011, and then especially 2014 for many emerging market economies, especially those in South America and Central America, that was their worst nightmare. The thing that they thought would never happen, dollars would always be plentiful, suddenly they were not. In El Salvador's case, you can look at any number of ways. I mean, they do have a central bank and they do have a store of foreign reserves. So they do have U.S. dollar reserves, never really that much, only a few billion dollars. But yet the trajectory of that follows everything else. They built up reserves as dollars became plentiful in the euro-dollar mania period. And then that growth started to taper off. And then you get to 2014-15 and suddenly we've got reversals, where U.S. dollar reserves in El Salvador suddenly drain. And then over the last couple of years, 2017 and 2018, despite globally synchronized growth and inflation, they didn't really have an increase in reserves. Then in 2019, they stopped reporting the reserve numbers to the IMF entirely, which is sort of another one of those clues that goes off in your head thinking they're not having, their currency is the U.S. dollar. They may be having more problems than they seem to be indicating publicly. So then you fast forward, we've got COVID, we've got the global recession, and all of a sudden in October of 2020, suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, their official reserve dollars plummets. Ironically, that's during the period when everybody thought QE, money printing, Bitcoin going crazy because the Fed's printing too much money, dollars crashing. And here's El Salvador thinking, where did all the dollars go? They just disappeared.
And I've pulled up a graph here. And Jeff, there's a dash line. So the full block, the area graph, that's their reserves. And then the dash line is sort of an early warning indicator. Do not drop below this. This is bad news. And they did drop below it, right?
Yeah, that's their what the IMF calls the predetermined short-term net drains, El Salvador officially or in some capacity owes U.S. dollars because they borrowed them on the euro-dollar market or in euro bonds or something. So they report to the IMF that, yeah, we owe dollars to everybody else around the world too. We don't just have dollars in our possession. We actually owe them elsewhere. And this is a short-term net drain, which is an important term too, because it means within 1 year, we expect this amount of dollars to have to go out of El Salvador. If they don't go out of El Salvador, we're in an Argentina situation, which is, we all know, is extremely bad in the U.S. dollar markets. So by March and April of 2021, this year, the level of U.S. dollar reserves officially in El Salvador fell below that mark, which meant that absent any kind of IMF rescue or some other form of rescue or some other form of money being able to pay, they were cooked. Their goose was cooked. They didn't have enough dollars to pay what they had already borrowed and was due within a year. They were screwed. And that was March, April, May of 2021.
Ecuador, in just the exact same time as El Salvador did this, they had to dollarize as well, but that was for different reasons. Their economy was disintegrating, and so they were looking to it to stabilize their economy. And I can see why they did it. And El Salvador, I can also see why they did it, as you explained, but this isn't the first time we have seen this mistake time and time again. For 200 years, we've seen cycles of globalization, and the same story plays out every single time. Back when the United States was an emerging market, you see advanced economy money centers have a surplus of money. They send it overseas. Something goes wrong in the advanced economy money center. It's not the emerging market that trips a wire. It's something in the advanced economies, London, Paris, Vienna, they say, something's not right, let's pull our money back, and they withdraw it. And that's happened time and time again, at least 6-7 times over the last 200 years. And so, but that's just the last 200 years, the modern economy. If we go back in time when we did in episode 79, part 3 in early June, we talked about how something similar happened in the 14th century, ghost money, how there was a bullion famine in Europe. And so what did enterprising individuals do? In the absence of sufficient access to acceptable money, clever private participants will do whatever they have to in order to continue conducting commerce as best they might. That's really the point for money. It's not itself wealth, rather a tool that a free market capitalist system might better create true wealth in the form of sustainable commerce. And here we are again, El Salvador's looking to Bitcoin as a ghost money way.
Yeah, it really is. And cryptocurrencies are a form of ledger money in the exact same method as this ghost money that showed up in the 14th and 15th century, which is simply, in the absence of bullion, you know, hard currency, they decided, well, we'll just keep a common ledger and write down who owes what based on what they created, these ideal forms of money, like an ideal form of pound sterling or Flemish silver, and said, this is how we're going to price goods based on this ideal currency, and we're going to keep track of who owes what on this ledger that we'll all keep together. And what is crypto? I mean, what is blockchain other than a distributed ledger? That's exactly the same thing. And I think what's going on, especially in Bitcoin and other places in the crypto space, is this misconception. People have this idea that cryptocurrencies are there and they've come about and they've proliferated and succeeded because of money printing. Dollar's going to crash. And they pile into these currencies, buy them up because they're trying to protect themselves and use crypto as a store of wealth. When in reality, it's this ghost money. The reason crypto is proliferating, come about and really had success is because it's filling a very, very different role. And that different role is elasticity, money shortage. The Fed isn't printing money, which is exactly the problem. We see the Fed doing these QEs because the system is short of money. The QEs are a Fed response and a very poor and ineffective one to this monetary shortage. And in the modern 21st century, here we have people all over the world, including now at least one government that's saying, we have a dollar problem. We can't get enough currency. We're going to turn to other forms of currency to try to create some form of to get some elasticity so that our economy doesn't completely go into the toilet. It's bad enough as it is. We'd like to have our monetary problem, which is not too much money or fear of a dollar crashing. It's too little dollars. We can't get enough of them. We need to try something else because nothing else seems to be working. And that's the consistent case here. As I explained in that earlier article and we talked about on that earlier episode, the euro dollar itself is a form of ghost money. It's a ledger. It's a distributed ledger. The difference here is that it's a private distributed ledger. It's a ledger that's distributed only amongst global banks, and therefore it's not as widely distributed as it is as a blockchain or decentralized as blockchain and cryptocurrencies are. But these are all the same types of things. And the euro dollar arose in the middle 1950s and proliferated in the 1960s because of the same money problem, the same monetary shortage, which was in the form of Triffin's paradox back then, which was the Bretton Woods gold exchange standard incompatible with the monetary needs of a growing globalized economy. So we have, you know, bullion famine in the 14th, 15th century leading to ledger money, money of account as it's called, or whatever you want to call it, decentralized ledger money, ghost money. You have the 50s and 60s, you've got Triffin's paradox of the real constraints of Bretton Woods leading to the euro dollar system, again, ghost money, money of account, ledger system. And now we have, since August of 2007, we have a euro dollar famine. We have a dollar shortage, not too much, a dollar shortage. And what do we see? Same exact thing. Ledger money, distributed technology, all of these other things, ghost money, money of account, whatever you want to call it. So crypto is very modern in how it's, you know, the technology involved and how it actually works. But the concept behind it is centuries, centuries old. And really, that's the problem with Bitcoin. And I think a lot of people who are investing in it and piling it, speculating in it, is they have the wrong idea about it. Their idea is 180 degrees opposite of what the people who are actually developing these cryptocurrencies are doing. The evolution of crypto is being driven not by money printing, but by lack of money printing. The opportunity for digital currency is because of this dollar shortage, the need for ledger money and elasticity being created because central banks are so ineffective and inept. So you have most of the public or whoever's investing in Bitcoin, they're doing it for all the wrong reasons, while the success and evolution of cryptocurrencies are for very, very different reasons, completely different purposes. And that's where we get this disconnect. And I think that's where that this disconnect is created. Now two bubbles in crypto, the first one back in 2017, and then of course beginning last October, which is an even bigger one. And now we're seeing the same exact thing. Now that it looks like everybody goes into the cryptocurrency because the dollar's gonna crash, you know, the price of Bitcoin goes through the roof, goes parabolic. And then after a while, people realize, wait a minute, the dollar's not crashing. In fact, we're seeing warning signs of deflation and dollar strength. And everybody piles out of, not everybody, but the speculators, the people who are buying Bitcoin and crypto for the wrong reasons, they pile out of it and suddenly the bubble collapses. But those who are using, those who are on the deeper level, fundamental level, using digital currencies, they're not doing it because of the same thing. They're not doing it because they believe the Fed's printing money or printing excessive amounts of money. It's because the opportunity exists because of this pre-existing dollar short, this euro dollar famine, this historical, as you would say, you might say, morphology. We're into another pattern here where we have monetary shortage and human ingenuity meeting that shortage, because money isn't the goal here. Commerce is the goal. Money is a tool to accomplish commerce. And if there's a shortage of money, you know, damn it, what you're going to find is humans becoming very creative. And crypto is a very, very creative, innovative, and I think ultimately long-run successful solution to the monetary problem that nobody really understands.
Let me just add a quick footnote. People who are new to the show, they're hearing dollar shortage from you over and over, and this may confound them. Just a very quick footnote. The vast majority of money created for today's world economy is created out of thin air by private banks in the form of credit. Overwhelming vast majority, and that's been the case for 70 years. And it grew at an exponential pace up until August of 2007. And ever since then, their balance sheets, bank balance sheets, have essentially gone sideways. That's the dollar shortage. Or if it isn't sideways, it's modestly higher, which is insufficient to what we've been accustomed to. Jeff, is there any final word that you wanted to give the audience before we call it a wrap?
Just to wrap up, final thought, that El Salvador, rather than confounding, and look, we're trying to help crypto. I mean, we're fans of cryptocurrency here. We're not bashing Bitcoin by any means.
Levered.
Exactly. No, I'm not buying cryptocurrency at these prices. And that's what I'm trying to say, is I'm trying to tell people that, look, you need to divorce yourself from what's driving people into these crypto bubbles, which is the wrong idea about the monetary system. They believe the Fed has printed excessive money, dollars going to zero. That's not the case. It's not the case. And if you want to make it the case to the exclusion of all the mountains of evidence otherwise, that's where you get into the religion of some of these things. And it's not just cryptocurrency. There's certain segments of the gold market and gold proponents too, that they take gold as religion, and the Fed's printing money. It has to be that way. And how can it be any other way? So what we're trying to do is say, look, crypto as an idea has a place, has an absolute place in the monetary system and the monetary hierarchy because of a dollar shortage that won't go away. The dollar shortage, this euro dollar famine, has opened the door for cryptocurrencies to take over the role of elasticity, because governments don't know what the hell's going on. The Federal Reserve doesn't. I mean, Jay Powell just figured out this thing about collateral. I mean, they're so far behind the times. By the time they catch up, it could be that cryptocurrencies have taken over. But it's not because they're printing money. It's because they don't print money and they don't know how to print money. So what we're saying here is, and El Salvador is a perfect anecdote. Let's not get carried away. It's just a small anecdote. But it is a perfect anecdote that puts all of these pieces in the correct order. El Salvador has a dollar shortage problem that they're trying to work through by using a form of private ledger money in exactly the way private ledger money has been used throughout history. So dollar shortage opens the door for other forms of money, which over time tend to succeed. And that's what we're looking at. So if you're piling into crypto thinking that the dollar is crashing and the Fed's printing money, I think you're gonna be really disappointed. If you take the longer run view of crypto in what really has potential here, you know, erasing or at least alleviating dollar shortage, I think you'll be much happier, much better, much more satisfied with the entire space.
Beautifully stated, Jeff. I'm going to ask the advertising team to put those laser eyes on your Twitter profile. All right, Jeff, I'll talk to you again next week.
All right, take care, Emil. Thanks.